and welcome to another Earshot podcast. This is David Rutledge. Great to have your company. Captain Cook. We all know Captain Cook. He landed on Australia's shores for the first time in 1770, and a lot of fuss has been made about his 8 days spent in Botany Bay. But he actually spent far longer on the shores of Wallumbalbiri, today known as the Endeavour River, which meets the sea at Cooktown in far north Queensland. Captain Cook was marooned there for 7 weeks after his ship was badly damaged on the reef. And this is the story of Cook in Cooktown and the locals who reenact his story every year, which they've been doing for over 5 decades. Our producer is Gretchen Miller.
It's Boxing Day 1971 when they found it. You know, it's just the size of it. It's quite amazing. People just sit here for hours, just sitting here and looking just in this gallery. It took quite a while for them to restore it, but visually, structurally, it's very imposing. It just draws people in.
What we're talking about here is an anchor, but not just any anchor. Twice as tall as I am, it's a beautiful piece of pitch black ironwork, which shows its life history and the deep scarring on the surface of the metal. This is the lost and then found again anchor of Captain James Cook's ship, the Endeavour, which hit what's now known as Endeavour Reef off the aptly named Cape Tribulation 245 years ago. Jackie Collins-Herman is manager of the James Cook Museum in Cooktown in far north Queensland, and she's a proud guardian of the anchor.
When Cook hit the reef, he hit it at high tide. He wasn't aware of that at that time. So what he did was jettison everything he could, basically, which was the 6 cannons, all the ballast, there was food stores. It would have been a terrifying 23-hour ordeal.
What else have we got here?
Well, we've got some of the pieces of coral that were actually taken from the anchor.
And there's a turtle shell.
There is a turtle shell.
Oh, yes, the turtles. Spending 47 days ashore, waiting out the trade winds, this display shell represents the turtles Cook took for food, without asking. Which was a shame, because up until that point, the visitors had been getting on well with the traditional indigenous owners.
So when they saw these turtles, you know, 12, it was just so many turtles. They didn't do anything on that first day, but they marched off. The next day, there were 10 men who came. They'd left their spears before they boarded the ship again. And they demanded 2 turtles, and that was refused. But this really angered our men.
Alberta Hornsby.
I'm an unlettered and self-proclaimed Bummer historian. I am a Kuki Mithatwada person. My clan land is Bulkun, and Bulkun is partly in Kuki Mithat and Kuki Alangi clan lands. That's who I am. Yeah.
It was this taking of a large number of sea turtles from Alberta Hornsby's ancestral lands, and Cook's subsequent refusal to return even 2 to the Gugu-Yimata traditional owners, which brought about the first conflict, but also the first reconciliation between Europeans and Aboriginal people. It was, I think, a deeply significant moment in our history. But let's rewind a little bit first and meet Alberta's comrade-in-arms, Loretta. Between them, they're the driving force behind the annual reenactments of Cook's time in what is now Cooktown.
My name is Loretta Sullivan, and I'm the president of the Cooktown Reenactment Association, also known as Mrs. Cook.
Did you or did you not find a safe passage?
Sir, I,
All right, you'll go back tomorrow morning and resume your search, and this time do your duty, please.
Aye, Captain.
And tell me about how you mobilise people to take part and play the roles. Tell me about your Captain Cook.
My normal Captain Cook is a builder who lives in Cooktown and works at Hopevale, but there's never any problem when we need him to do it. We have a basic few cast members who really don't want to not be involved, but this year Rick Ashcroft, who was our Captain Cook, was there, and I didn't have to get my spare Captain Cook or my extra spare Captain Cook to help.
And you have quite a few costumes hanging up here. Are these the ones you use?
Yes, all the red ones are the Marines, and Captain Cook and Lieutenant Gore both take their costumes home because they just like to...
They like to get their buttons straight.
And the white's white. They have to be white.
The three of us hop in Loretta's car and drive to a viewing point at the mouth of Cooktown's Endeavour River.
So, where are we, ladies?
This is Grassy Hill. It's always windy up here, but it's the best view in town.
So the river is snaking away down there. It's quite wide.
And it's really amazing, and I can imagine when you look at the map that Cook constructed of the Endeavour River, I reckon he would have come up here and sat down because it's exactly as we see it here.
What we're surrounded by is a spectacular set of hills.
Well, where we're standing is like on the edge of Winewood, the clan land, and Gumme just here. You've got Moombard, just over here, and then that long mountain, that's Wulkan, and on the other side of that is my ancestral lands. And Wulkan means sheltered, so our clan land is sheltered by mountains.
This is what Captain Cook would have encountered, I'd say, during his time here in 1770. And that's why he had to spend as long as he did here, partially because of the wind. The ship was actually repaired in about 10 days.
And he had to wait for a land breeze, which doesn't happen very often. I mean, these are the southeast trade winds, so it would have been hard for them to have gotten out of this area.
They came up here at low tide so that they could see the reef. They saw so much, and Cook said it was like a labyrinth that they had to get through. And it was quite very scary for them to know that they were surrounded by so much reef.
From high on Grassy Hill, you can see in the landscape how Cook's story unfolded. But just as it would have been exactly 245 years ago, the relentless trade winds are buffeting. It's too windy to stay up here long. So let's go back to town and join another player and find out what went on to so disrupt Cook's journey north. This is Jeff Weingarth, who leads tours around the museum and plays the Endeavour's Lieutenant Gore in the annual reenactments.
It's a moonlit night on about the 10th of June, and it's a lovely night, and he hits the reef, what's now called Endeavour Reef, 70 k's south of here and about 15 or 16 k's offshore. And he hits it at high tide. That's not a very good time to hit a reef. So anyway, he sticks the boat fast and he can't shift it. 23 hours later, the ship is starting to break up a bit, and Cook is starting to get worried that if the wind comes up, that what's he going to do? You know, lives are going to be lost for sure. So he throws overboard over 50 tonnes worth of equipment. He had six deck cannon. They all went overboard. He threw over casks, crates, stores, ballast, anything that had any weight in it at all. And at the next high tide, he puts out two sea anchors, hooks those to capstan and windlass, which are like blocks and tackle. And when the ship started to move at that high tide, he broke the Endeavour free. When he broke the Endeavour free from the reef, part of the reef broke off and stayed in the hull. Had that not happened, the ship would have sunk. And that's not my opinion, that's what Cook wrote when he got here to the Endeavour River. He wrote in his diary, and the hull was big enough to sink us. So they were pumping with three of the four pumps, the fourth one was broken. Every single person on the ship, including Banks, Saunder, Cook himself, Gore, everyone had a turn on the pumps. 15 minutes was all you could spend, and then you're totally exhausted. So you couldn't keep doing that. So midshipman Monkhouse came to Cook with the idea of putting a sail underneath the boat. They call it fathering.
To block the hole.
You don't just whack a sail under the boat, though. You've got to first prepare the sail, and they sewed on pieces of wool and garment and those kind of things, and they smothered it with anything that was sticky, muck and dirt. They used oakum, short lengths of rope that you open up. And anyway, they sewed all this stuff on. Then they put the sail underneath the boat, And when it got to the spot where the hole was, they pull it up as tight as they can, and the hope is the suction of the water going through the hole pulls the sail against the side of the boat and seals it. Well, that worked. They sneaked the boat up the coastline here. It took them 7 days into the Endeavour River, the Cook named, of course, and he beached it, turned it on its side, that's called careening, and 11 days later the ship has been repaired completely, totally seaworthy, sitting in the middle of the Endeavour River, but he can't go because the wind's in the wrong direction and the wind stays in the wrong direction for another 37 days.
So there Cook sat, with botanists Joseph Banks and Daniel Solander and all the crew. The story of Cook's 7 weeks in Cooktown has been reenacted here every single year since 1959. And Loretta and Alberta are determined to keep the story alive through re-examining the history.
You know, as one of our aunties told me, they said, you know, Captain Cook, he swallowed a hook and found himself in the history books. All we knew about Captain Cook was that, you know, he discovered Australia. He was from England. He was in a boat. And he landed at the Endeavour River and was gone. And I think that would be the experience of all Australians when I went to school, not just Indigenous people. But I do know that Captain Cook does not enjoy a very good reputation amongst Aboriginal people, including the people up here.
He came to represent the white culture, basically.
That's right. He came to represent the white culture that has oppressed our people for, you know, since the colonisation of Australia.
Alberta's uncle Eric Dirrell was the first Indigenous man to be voted into the Queensland Parliament. Working with a Sydney friend, John McDonald, he convinced her to at least look at Cook's journals, and they ended up rewriting the reenactment script, redressing the balance of the story. They brought remarkable cultural insights into Cook's reports.
Now, I reluctantly looked through the journals because I didn't see any significance of the journals at first. This led myself and my Uncle Eric to have lots and lots of discussions.
What struck you particularly?
Well, for instance, Cook had been here for almost a month before our people made contact.
That's a long time.
That is a long time. We wondered, you know, why did they take so long? And according to my Uncle Eric, he said that our people had this oral history of our ancestors coming from the west in the form of the Mass Plover and the Wallaroo, and they travelled to the east and they were awaiting their return. In the spiritual belief, Kukiyamithit spiritual belief was based on is the principle of a wawu. Now, wawu is your inner self. And our people believe that at death, your wawu went and it travelled in the east. And when it came back, it would be changed and your wawu would be in the form of a being that was white.
And so they didn't want to approach these white people?
They didn't want to approach them. They observed. They would have noticed the colour of their skin, a direction from which they came, and they would have just waited and observed. And I'm sure that they would have wondered, well, if this is our ancestors, maybe, you know, they would know the law.
Once contact was made, this first contact, botanist Joseph Banks wrote that the two parties became good friends. The Europeans collected well over 100 words of the Kukiyimitha language. And one of these words was for a creature which is synonymous with Australia today, and that was kangaroo, a mispronunciation of the word gungaroo. The kangaroo was first spotted here in Cooktown.
Doctor, we have an animal!
Jeff Weingarth, a.k.a. Lieutenant Gore.
Capital Gore!
They saw this thing bouncing around and said, what's that?
The first and only one ever taken. This is
and one of the Kukiyimitha men said, Gungaroo. And Parkinson, he wrote down 132 Kukiyimitha words and their meanings. This is another first for Cooktown. That's the very first record of any Aboriginal writing ever. So he wrote down Kangaroo instead of Gungaroo. So we all speak a bit of Gukuyimata. And if you think about the kangaroo, it was sighted here, it was drawn here, and it was shot here. Gore shot one. I take a place of gore in the reenactment. And it was cooked here, and it was eaten here. So there's some first for the kangaroo too.
In Botany Bay, they saw some dung that they thought may have come from a quadruped, but that, as far as I can tell from reading the journals, that's the only instance that we've found, and they shot it. They named it during talks with the Aboriginal people, and Banks took the pelt back to England, we believe, but I think it was blown up in the war in one of the museums, so we can't get that back.
The meetings were fine. Banks wrote that they soon became good friends. They collected 150 words of the Kukyimatha language.
Were they all nouns?
They were all nouns, but there were some verbs. There was a word that said, translated, Yapangatuko, which means, that is my big brother, my own big brother. There was also a word, when you read it, it was Garanatu, but when it's translated, we believe that it said Gurano, which means I'm going to tell you something.
That's pretty magic, isn't it?
Well, it was a magical moment for us when we were able to interpret these word lists, and it made the whole story come alive. And with the knowledge of culture and customs that my father and also my uncle had and other elders from Hopevale had, it just added a different side to the story, because we'd always thought, you know, we were our people. Did they just let this fellow come in and do whatever he did and didn't have any interactions? And here this whole world, this whole story was opening up to us.
So how did that make you feel to have that change in your interpretation and understanding of those events?
Well, for me, at least it was a shared history that has been written into the history books, not only here in Australia, but in England and right throughout the world. But our side of the story has never, ever been told. And here we have this historical event that involved people from around the Endeavour River who acted with diplomacy, they acted with caution, they followed their laws.
This was an exciting time for Joseph Banks and Daniel Solander, and they collected a vast number of specimens, far more than they did in Botany Bay, and some of them are housed at James Cook University's Cairns campus. Darren Crane is Professor and Director of the Australian Tropical Herbarium there.
So this is the herbarium collection in here. Basically, it's a collection of scientific specimens of plants. We've got some very old specimens, and we have three of the collections that were collected and processed by Sir Joseph Banks when the Endeavour ran aground on the reef just off Cape Tribulation. During those 48 days, Joseph Banks, his scientific off-sider Daniel Solander, and their team of eight others basically moved out through the landscape every day collecting plants and illustrating animals. And they collected some thousands of specimens, and we have three of those original collections here in the herbarium.
Thousands, was it?
Yeah, thousands of specimens. On the entire voyage, there was over 30,000 collections made. I haven't yet been able to determine exactly how many they collected at the Endeavour River, because while some of the specimens have been repatriated back to Australia, there's still a lot of material that's yet to be processed from that voyage over 240 years ago, and are literally just sitting in the bowels of the Natural History Museum in London. Still in the copies of Milton's Paradise Lost, in which they were pressed during the voyage.
That's a fantastic story. Mm. I didn't know that.
Mm. I've seen some of them. I had the extreme good fortune of being allowed into those archives and shown by the curator those unprocessed specimens. And it really is quite a remarkable experience to peel open the pages of, you know, Milton's Paradise Lost and just see these collections that have not been touched since they were collected 240 years ago. It almost was paradise, or lost in paradise for them, wasn't it? You know, had they not been able to repair the ship, or had the hull been more serious and they actually sank on the reef, none of those specimens would ever have made it back to England.
So tell me what we've got here. I mean, I feel quite emotional looking at these. Mm. They're shabby and brown and, you know, nondescript really, but this one here has still got traces of what, flower or bud?
Yes, those are small flowers of this plant. And so there are three species here, and the names are Cleoxylon hillii, Timonius timon, and Pithecolobium grandiflora. So each of these three species is really still quite common in that area, and in fact right across northern Queensland. So there's nothing particularly remarkable about these three specimens in terms of the species they represent, but what of course is remarkable about them is they are probably the oldest relics of scientific activity, European scientific activity, on the Australian continent.
One of the things that's really thrilling about this is that it's in a box of silky oak, but around it is, you know, piles of papers and the latest mail and, you know, folders and bits. So it's very much part of a working collection in a way.
Well, absolutely. I mean, while these are culturally and scientifically important specimens, you know, they are still just specimens in an herbarium, you know, and they still are used in the same way that all the other specimens in the herbarium are.
These specimens were gathered during the 47 days the Endeavour crew spent stuck on the Endeavour River. And Alberta Hornsby says it was lucky that Cook's ship had landed on the south side of the river.
Wimbuud, it's spelled W-A-Y-M-B-U-U-R-R, Wimbuud. And it's one of 32 clan lands of the Kukyimitha tribal nation. And it extends from the Annan River to the Endeavour River, and west at to the Poison Creek area. So this area was a neutral zone. It was the homelands of the Wimbuud Wadda people, but people came here. They came here to settle disputes. They came here to give birth. They came here in seasons of plenty, and they came here for gatherings. And Cook was very fortunate that he landed on the south banks of the Endeavour River. Our people, they knew that they could not kill anyone on this land.
But just 9 days after the first contact, there was conflict, and this changed everything.
There were 12 turtles on board the ship. Now, these turtles, they would have known, would have come from a breeding place. It was connected to a sacred storyline. So when they saw these turtles, the next day they came, there were 10 men who came. They'd left their spears with some young fellows before they boarded the ship again. And they demanded a turtle or two turtles. And that was refused them because it was one thing that Cook wouldn't part with because they needed it for their journey home. So as they went off, there was a conflict, just a small skirmish. As they went off, one of the men took a fire stick from the campsite and put the whole settlement area on fire. Fortunately, everything had been put back on the boat, and there was only a little suckling pig that was burnt. And the man with the fire, he ran to the stream where the sailors were washing the clothes, and he put that area on fire. And this is when Cook took his musket and fired two musket shots, and blood was spilt on Wimbuud land. When our other men came to rescue the wounded man, once they saw the guns pointed towards them, their spears were confiscated. So they just walked along the foreshore up to the place about a mile. And Cook and his lot, they sat on some rocks, and out of the bush came a little old man, and he carried a spear that had a broken tip.
That's significant, isn't it?
I think it's significant. It indicated something that Cook could understand. They didn't want any more fighting. But also on top of that, he performed a gesture, a custom
call ngalangondame, which means collecting your sweat from under your arms, which is a very personal gesture. Usually this sweat is rubbed over people, but he grabbed it from under his arms, he blew it in the air, he mumbled some words as he came towards Cook. And it's just described so simply in the journals, but the intention of bringing about peace was just so significant, just the way it was written down. The spears were returned, and from then on, that conflict was settled.
After that, the two parties barely communicated, and 10 days later, Cook set sail.
The journals say that that night, all the hills around the Endeavour River were put on fire. So we thought, well, the only reason that it could be put on fire was to cleanse the area of the badness that had happened here.
Don't come back.
Don't come back. You know, good riddance, don't come back.
From what I have seen of the natives of New Holland, they may appear to some to be the most wretched people upon the earth. But in reality, they are far happier than we Europeans, being wholly unacquainted not only with the superfluous, but the necessary conveniences so much sought after in Europe.
Keeping this story alive through the reenactments is a life's passion for Alberta and Loretta. They want to make sure both visitors and the broader Cooktown community know and take proud possession of this important history.
Well, I don't normally participate. I do all the preparation and support for all the cast, the crew and the organisation. But this year I did participate as a narrator. Our job is to tell a story, but we're getting a lot of really good comments and support from people who are actually watching it, and they think it's absolutely wonderful.
This year I felt really happy that I was able to take part in this reenactment, even though I felt stupid that was a moment, because I was the only one who knows the story properly and how vital it was to tell the story. And this year we had a group of young men who participated as in the leading parts, and I felt happy that I was able to teach them.
How did they take it?
I think they loved it. I think they really did enjoy it, and I think they felt proud that they were able to do it. But I do feel a responsibility of telling the story, because, you know, we're surrounded by the landscape, the story places, and we're surrounded by that location on where these events took place.
Cook in Cooktown. That was produced by Gretchen Miller with sound engineer Judy Rapley. And thanks to all the Cooktown locals who took part. Photos of the reenactment can be found on our website along with handy links, and you can leave us a comment or share the story at abc.net.au/rn. Look for Earshot on the program menu. And with that, we come to the end of another Earshot podcast. This is David Rutledge saying thanks for your company, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.
Hi there, Sarah Kanoski here. Now, Books and Arts came to you live from the Brisbane Writers' Festival. We heard Laurie Penny on modern feminism, took a look at what drugs really do to your brain, considered the new generation of male writers sharing some very personal stories, and took a look at the hidden relationship between crime and mateship. If you missed it, you can podcast the program anytime from Books and Arts at the RN homepage.